Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, the Philippines wants an international tribunal over its long-running dispute with China over maritime claims. The slaughter of 700 dolphins in Solomon Island causes international outrage. And then our focus today is going to be on design, more specifically, designers here in Asia, with the leading expert, Imin Pao. We have this and some great music at the end of the program, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. The Philippines wants an international tribunal to get involved in its long-running dispute with China over contested maritime claims. China is claiming rights over islands, reefs, and atolls in the South China Sea that would give control over shipping lanes and access to any petroleum reserves in the waters nearby. But these claims are disputed by the Philippines, as well as Vietnam, Burma, Taiwan, and Malaysia. We have this story from Liam Cochrane.
Before we get into some analysis, let's hear from the Philippines Foreign Affairs Secretary, Albert Del Rosario, and let's hear his explanation as to why Manila is taking this issue to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea Tribunal.
The Philippines has taken the step of bringing China before an arbitral tribunal under Article 287 and Annex 7 of the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, in order to achieve a peaceful and durable solution to the dispute over the West Philippine Sea. The Philippines has exhausted almost all political and diplomatic avenues for a peaceful negotiated settlement of its maritime dispute with China. We hope that the arbitral proceedings shall bring the dispute to a durable solution.
And that's the Philippines Foreign Affairs Secretary Albert Del Rosario. So what does this move actually mean? Well, it's not as simple as it sounds. The tribunal is not being asked to arbitrate on the sovereignty of the disputed islands, rocks and marine territory. In effect, it's not being asked to decide who owns the area. But to help us work through some of these issues, we're joined now by Carl Thayer from the University of New South Wales. Carl Thayer, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Liam.
Now, can you explain for us what role the Philippines wants this UN tribunal to play?
Right. Having said that it's exhausted all possibilities of a settlement, it's fulfilled a requirement to then say to the UN Secretary General and to the tribunal, please interfere and make a legal ruling on how to apply and interpret international law in the following areas. Is the Philippines entitled to a territorial sea exclusive economic zone from its baselines, yes or no? And if so, is China's claim to a nine-dash line cuts into this legal or not? And the Philippines says, we want you to declare it invalid, unlawful. Next, that China has occupied what they call submerged features. They're not islands and rocks in international law which are entitled to maritime zones, but are in fact China has artificially constructed on them. The Philippines says, call a spade, we want this tribunal to rule that these have no claims to any jurisdiction. And then saying, well, China has also lawfully interfered with the Philippines exercising its sovereign rights. We want that to be stopped. We want, by establishing what our rights are in the previous 2 points above, for the tribunal to rule on that. And then finally, to make an argument that China should bring its domestic law in conformity with international law and withdraw from these features.
Now, just to perhaps expand a little bit on the issue of submerged reefs, islands and rocks, can you explain for us the difference if the UN tribunal ruled that the structures built by China were on a submerged reef rather than an island or a rock? What is the actual difference there?
Right. Well, under international law, an island is naturally formed. It can support human habitation, economic function, and is given a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, continental shelf. And the nation occupying that island has sovereign rights over its resources, the fish, oil, and gas. If it's a rock, it cannot sustain habitation. It's above water at high tide, and it's entitled to a 12 nautical mile territorial sea with the same rights. If it's not, it's a low tide elevation. It's either part of the continental shelf, If it's artificially built on, it's not a rock or an island. And what's happened is that China and other claimants, Vietnam, have built on these and are acting as if they were rocks or islands and making extensive claims. So what the Philippines is trying to do is to demolish all that and get back to basics and say a rock is a rock, and when it's not, no nation, including China, should have the ability to declare maritime zones or interfere with the Philippines passing over an area around a submerged feature.
Let's get back to basics as far as the tribunal is concerned. If these issues do go to the tribunal, who are the members of that panel that would adjudicate?
Right. Well, every country that signed UNCLOS nominates four nominees, so there's already a list. And then when a dispute like this occurs, the very last sentence of the Philippines' submission to the UN nominated one of the judges. The arbitral panel will be five. China has 30 days to respond and nominate one of its own. The two parties then have 60 days to nominate the other three and to agree among those three who should be the president, so a tribunal of five. If they can't reach agreement, the current head of the International Tribunal on Law of the Sea is empowered to nominate from that panel of nominees worldwide, but not to pick anybody who's from a country or living in a country that's in dispute.
And what power does the tribunal have?
Well, the first thing it must do is determine whether the claim is an abuse of international law or has a firm foundation. Then rule whether it actually has jurisdiction over the matter. And then three, set up its own procedures and then proceed to hear the case. And when it makes a decision, that decision is to be binding. But there's no enforcement mechanism.
So if there's no enforcement, what's the point then?
Well, there's the normative pressure of international law, the international community on particular countries. In the matter at hand, it would totally undermine China's case if the arbitral tribunal went against China and ruled the nine-dash line unlawful, because China's response so far has just been to reiterate that it has indisputable sovereignty without proving that case in international law, and then arguing, well, we want to keep going with discussions. And the Philippines says they've been going on for 17 years. They're unlikely to reach a settlement.
Interesting the phrase that Albert Del Rosario used, that the Philippines had exhausted almost all political and diplomatic avenues. Of course, it was the Philippines that spoke out at the recent ASEAN meetings late last year when Cambodia misrepresented the ASEAN position on South China Sea issues. Is this something of a vote of no confidence in ASEAN by the Philippines?
No, the Philippines is doing what all members of ASEAN want, to uphold the UN Charter. The UN Charter is the starting point for the UNCLOS, the UN Convention on Law of the Sea, that nations should settle their disputes peacefully. Well, the Philippines has been the victim of Chinese assertiveness and coercion. So by going to international law, it's saying that the attempt between two parties, China and the Philippines, has been exhausted. 17 years of discussions have not got an agreement on anything so far, and discussions began after the occupation of Mystery Reef in 1995. So it's proceeding, it's trying to settle it bilaterally. It's invited China, China's already turned it down prior to this latest maneuver, to try to bring in international arbitration. So theoretically, ASEAN should be quite happy that two are doing it, and indeed other members, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore, in their separate bilateral disputes, have agreed to take their disputes to the International Court of Justice, and in all cases, they've accepted the referees, the court's decision, and specific islands that were in dispute have had their sovereignty determined.
That was Carl Thayer from the Defence Force Academy at the University of New South Wales, speaking to Liam Cochrane. The slaughter of over 700 dolphins in Solomon Islands is causing an international outrage. Earlier this week, the village of Fanali on South Malata captured and killed over 700 dolphins in protest, they say, to non-payment of funds promised by a conservation movement to forego their trading hunting practices. But the conservation group, the Earth Island Institute, is disputing that version of events, saying the money has been provided to the village representatives, who have to explain where it went. We have this report from Campbell Clooney.
By any measure, the number of dolphins caught and slaughtered by the members of Funnelay Village in South Malaita is staggering.
The number of dolphins that were caught was around 700 to 900.
Atkin Fakaya is the chairman of the Funnelay Honiara-based association, representing those from the island village living in the capital and also acting as the village's representative there. Traditionally, dolphins are used to provide meat and income for the village, with the men also using the mammal's teeth to pay a bride's price. For the past 2 years, that village, as well as other villages on Malaita, have been parties to a memorandum of understanding with the conservation group, the Earth Island Institute, which provides funding to develop other income-producing projects in return for the villages not hunting dolphins. But now that MOU appears to have been scrapped.
The issue of them going back fishing for and killing dolphins was on the understanding that Earth Island has reluctant to pay the agreed amount that was due to the community, and so they just felt as if they was just disappointed and dissatisfied over the attitude of Earth Island.
The director of the Institute, Lawrence Makili, has disputed the village's version of events leading up to the slaughter.
The communities use that as an excuse to have a reason for them to do what they were doing. The Island Institute has played their part by providing small grants to the community for them to set up small income generation projects. Within the 2 years term, we first gave out some money to the community, which is $300,000 SBD, that is $100,000. And during the distribution of the funds to, to individual members of individual families, the strategy that they set up in the community for the distribution of funds was not happy by other members of the community. And we also went back to the community and have some sort of, you know, discuss with them, and that they do agree that the funds should be channeled to the family people based in Honiara in the city. But that second tranche that we gave out to them is worth about 400,000 SPD dollars, Solomon Island dollars. And that money never reached the community. It was sunk in Honiara by their own community members who were given the trustee for them.
Mr. Fakaya hasn't commented on what the EII money was used for or where it went, but he defends it being distributed by village members living in the capital.
We are more literate than them who are back in the villages to speak on their behalf. Earth Island should have consulted us firstly.
Earth Island is still straight on the table. It is these communities, influenced by their people who are living in Honiara, working in Honiara, got, you know, fortnight pay in Honiara, influenced these people in the village to do whatever they want in order to lure us to give more money. But we cannot give more money because they are not accountable for it. There are three communities in Malaita that we are working with. The other two communities, we are still maintaining our relationship. They still maintain, you know, our relationship within the MOU. Only one community that, you know, they thought that, you know, they would do whatever they want in order for us to come back to the table. But I think I'm not coming back to the table because of the evil thing that they have done.
The only avenue which we can really get back to them and to force them to get the payments done was to get them into a court to take up a lawsuit with them.
While the Institute and the village of Funnelay continue to argue, the slaughter has resulted in international outrage and the sort of attention no government wants. In recent years, Solomon Islands has been criticised for allowing the live export of dolphins from its waters. As well, the international companies interested in investing in its tuna fisheries and canneries have made it clear a dolphin-friendly environment in the island nation is essential. Lawrence McKillie from the Earth Island Institute says events this week could leave that image in tatters.
First message that they sent, this country sent, it is a problem with the government of Solomon Islands. They don't see the dolphin issue as a very sensitive issue to the tuna industry. The tuna industry was very sensitive to the dolphin issue. As we all aware that the biggest market for tuna flakes, tuna loin, is Europe. And it is the high demand from Europe that the products have to be dolphin friendly.
Asian designers are increasingly becoming well known on the international stage. Everything from fashion, furniture, high technology. In recent years, a local Taiwan company by the name of HTC, that make mobile phones and smartphones, has become a name for itself in North America and Europe. This started more than 30 years ago, when a Taiwan bicycle company that nobody knew at the time, Giant, started to market their bicycles around the world. They've now become the largest manufacturer of bicycles. But what is the future for Asian designers and the companies that are behind them? To find out more, our guest today is Imin Pao. He's the owner of a company based here in Taiwan that does a lot of business in China called The Brand Partner. And I met up with him recently to find out what the future holds.
I think the design follows the industry. What you see, the design will need it because the industry flourish. And I think you're talking about the Asia region. I think more probably more specific to Taiwan and China. Now, Taiwan, of course, we are the island for semiconductor and computers. So there's going to be a lot of company that needs to have acquired design for products that they wanted to put up. And same thing for China. So I think it's gonna be the needs will be of course the demands will be much more stronger than ever because all these companies in China and Taiwan want to put up their own product.
Right, because for many years, for example, here in Taiwan, there's a bicycle company called Giant, and 20 years ago, 25 years ago, they were leading the way in the design of bicycle technology. They're now the largest bicycle producer in the world. They've surpassed everybody, and we're now starting to see that say their bicycles are starting to look beautiful finally. Because there's always this argument going on between engineer designers and designer designers. Engineer designers, they make it work. But it sometimes looks a little funny, and then the other designers come in. Because Taiwan has this technical capability, do you see now that they're going to start introducing, say, more beautiful products in line, let's say, like with Apple design and other companies? We see that with HTC, for example.
Right. Well, of course, the Asian, or China or Taiwan, they wanted to try to do something beautiful. I mean, everyone does wanted to do that. But I think there's a really you have to discuss this problem or this aspect deeply. You really have to understand the culture and the education and how people are trained to design to appreciate beauty. And I think they will a lot of them go to, of course, study in the U.S. or foreign country, try to get the foreign education and try to increase their ability to design something beautiful. But I think still the breakthrough will still come from Europe and U.S. instead of from China. Even though the market is here, the factory is here, but they're still trying to follow the trend, not leading it. I don't see for the next 10 or 20 years, I don't see Asia design. There will be stronger presence in the world, but they are probably not able to lead any new trend just yet.
Do you think a lot of that has to do with education, for example, in many fields, in the arts, for example? In a lot of schools in the West, like they're teaching music or drama, they teach people to improvise. They've become creative without, you know, following the text. Do you think that is part of it?
I think education and culture is everything. I was just talking to my friends the other day that one of my kids grows up, she listened to music sometime. And a lot of her friends and classmates at age 8, they don't listen to music anymore. They don't appreciate contemporary music. They don't appreciate Prince. They don't know the difference between Alicia Keys and Macy Gray. So they don't appreciate music. So they don't have that kind of creativity in their blood. But what they have is it's more they play it more safe. That's what it fits to Asia culture. They play it more safe, and they do more of improve than initiate, because to create something original you have to take a lot of bold chances. And that's what American education and propaganda are very good at. They encourage you to take a bold step to go where no man has gone before, which leads a lot of failure. But I think a Chinese education leads to more safe. And you're trying to improve something people already have. So we basically, you know, we're taking a lot of Western goods and we improve them. That's what Japanese are very famous for in the 80s. They try to improve design, but they are not original. You know, all the Lexus automobile are basically improvement from Mercedes-Benz, which is already a benchmark, but they try to improve it.
That's sort of like what Sony did with televisions.
Right. And now, of course, you know, Apple come in and rewritten all the rules, and then, of course, the Nokia and Sony are no longer on the map, which is they are the biggest giant in the 90s. So you can see, I think American education, I'm come from American education background. I was trained, educated in States, and I really appreciate the way they train you. They really open up the possibility that you can create. And I think design at its top form comes from those original thoughts and original mindset.
What about a time... Do you see it when Asian brands will be on the international market in Europe and in North America the same way with North American brands?
I think we'll see more international Taiwan or China brand, of course, because they're going to be out there somehow, like a HTC and other, you know, giants and all that. We're going to see more of that, but I doubt there will be a leading brand in that category, simply because Chinese are not born leaders in creativity. We are also not aimed for that. I think Korea has a lot of ambitions trying to be the creative capital, city, or country of the world, and you can see the ambitions and it pays off. I don't know if that's going to be true for China and Taiwan yet. I don't see it in their agenda.
Competition must be fierce because you don't just have China, you have South Korea, like you just mentioned, you have Japan. You also have new emerging markets in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Burma. They're all coming to the top. Do you think that there's going to be more cooperation or there's just going to be more competition?
I don't think it's going to be a competition. Those are small Asian countries that you mentioned about. They don't have a giant manufacturer capability. I think manufacturer is still holds a great strength in the future of the design. So wherever the country holds a lot of manufacturer power, like UK or British in the Industrial Revolution, if you hold the manufacturer capability, then you hold the key to create. And then all this southern country you're talking about, the Thailand and Vietnam, they're going to be slow. And I think China is going to be a dominant force. They're going to be a giant leap than any other countries trying to create something new. So I think there will some will emerge in the next 10 years. You will see something like IBM, Nokia, this giant size, very design-oriented company from China. I think that could happen, but not any other small countries just yet.
I suppose in a case like China, it is quite challenging because for many years, ever since China opened up, a lot of designs were copied and sold under different brands, but they looked just like the original. Do you think it's going to be difficult for China to say, look, we have an original design because of this stigma that's attached to them that's been there for many years?
I think it had to be education. It's going to take about 30 and 40 years for Chinese to realize to do something original is a pride. But right now, because they can just do a lot of copycat and they make a lot of money. And if they can make a lot of money, their life is so much better than before. There's no need to do something original. They just wait for somebody else to come up with something good and they improved it. So I think that it's incentive. For longest time, there's no incentive to be creative and original. There's no need for that because you don't make money that way. Your parents doesn't make money that way. You see people already copy. Japan has been doing that for the longest time. They're still doing that. They still improve some other things. I mean, without Apple, you know, the whole industry won't exist about this, you know, touch screen, all that. I mean, Apple didn't invent that, but of course they come up with a way to package together. And then that, therefore, you have Apple, then you have HTC and Samsung. That's how I view it. So I think China or Taiwan will never be a original leading country just yet. I don't know if that day will come, but I don't see it happening in any time soon. And I think America and Europe will still have those original spark, and then Asia will take those sparks and improve it and make money out of it.
Now, you've been doing this for a number of years. You've been involved in this industry for a number of years. If somebody, let's say, in their early 20s came to you and wanted advice for say, education, what would you suggest to them?
Well, design. You mean for design, right?
For design, yes.
Education. I would suggest them, of course, definitely go abroad, study in U.S. and Europe, really get the sense of the different culture, because I think they are more grand. They care more about other things. They have more values than just money. I think that China and Taiwan has really, I think it's lost a lot of values, and those values actually contribute to your ability to create. And if you only aim for money and wealth and success and fame, I don't think you can create something as dreamy as you know, you cannot create animations, movies, buildings, objects based on those criteria. So anybody who's trying to go into this field in China and Asia, I would suggest them to really put a lot of time, learn from Europe, and then trying to work in Asia, because that's where the market and the opportunities are. But you need to have a world mindset.
Your company, The Brand Partner, works closely with other companies to brand their products and to brand their image. You have had experience outside Taiwan. What are some of the different challenges, let's say? I mean, is it more challenging here to brand a product than, let's say, in Europe or the United States?
Well, our strength is basically more global village. When clients come to us, they value us because our ability to gather a group of best people around the world, the best photographer from Belgium, the best makeup from Paris, the best model from Czechoslovakia. We are able to bring the best people around the field and serve our China client. That's our strength. So it is a challenge, but it's also more, for us, it's more of an opportunity, because we're not able to do that in Taiwan, because the client's size are not, they can't afford this kind of a team. But in China, they have the budget, so we're very happy working in China to serve our client this way. That's where we pride our strength, to able to build this sort of a global Olympic team together. That's basically what we do.
And I was speaking there with Imin Pao from The Brand Partner. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. We end today with South Korean group Super Junior and one of their hit songs, Sexy, Free, and Single. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Powell. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone. Sexy, free, and single, I'm ready to bingo. Hey, 누구나 십선이 갖는 건 재미없잖아. 좀 더 높게, 세게, 라라라라라. 위에서 봐 견뎌낸 착각에 닿게 되는 것. 좀 더 버텨, 버텨, 라라.